Sehr geehrter Herr Minister, Minister Borg, Exzellenzen, sehr geehrte Abgeordnete, meine sehr geehrten Damen und Herren. Ich darf Sie alle sehr herzlich willkommen heißen zu dieser 7. Ludwig-Erhard-Lecture der Initiative Neue Soziale Marktwirtschaft. In den vergangenen Jahren behandelten die Lectures stets besondere ökonomische und ordnungspolitische Fragen. Selten war das Thema der Veranstaltung jedoch von so brennender Aktualität wie in diesem Jahr. Wir freuen uns daher besonders, heute einen Referenten hier begrüßen zu dürfen, der für den schwedischen Wirtschaftserfolg der vergangenen Jahre wesentliche Mitverantwortung trägt und der zugleich über umfangreiche Erfahrungen in der Finanzbranche verfügt. Dear Minister Borg, it gives us a great pleasure to welcome you here in Berlin for the 7th Ludwig Erhard Lecture, and we are aware of the difficulties for you to come in this noontime because you had to do your political job in your country, and it was not an easy one because the decisions were taken today. In these turbulent times, all governments and financial institutions are extremely busy trying to find ways to respond to the current challenges of the financial markets. Therefore, we are very much honored that you have taken the time to speak to us today, Mr. Minister, on such a busy day for you. We could not have found a more distinguished speaker for today's Ludwig Erhard Lecture, someone who has been actively involved in both financial institutions and government. If you allow, I would like to continue in German a little bit, but you have the chance for getting the translation. Über viele Jahre bestimmen Sie nun schon die schwedische Politik wesentlich mit. Zu Beginn der 90er Jahre waren Sie mehrere Jahre als politischer Berater des damaligen Ministerpräsidenten Carl Bildt tätig. Damals erlebten Sie die Bankenkrise an vorderster Front mit, und für die damals in Schweden gemachten Erfahrungen interessiert man sich in Deutschland derzeit besonders. Seit damals haben Sie sich zudem als Finanzexperte über die Grenzen Schwedens hinaus einen Namen gemacht. Als Chefvolkswirt der ABN AMRO Bank und Chefanalyst der Skandinaviska und Skilda Banken, SEB, beeinflussten Sie die Praxis der Wirtschaftsbranche mit. Als Experte für finanzpolitische Fragen berieten Sie zudem die Führung der schwedischen Zentralbank. Und seit 2006 sind Sie nun Finanzminister Ihres Landes und haben sich den Ruf eines Reformers erarbeitet, der auch vor provokanten Statements nicht zurückschreckt. Seit 2 Jahren treiben Sie die Reformpolitik in Schweden voran, und der bisherige Erfolg gibt Ihnen recht. Die Haushaltsüberschüsse, die Fortschritte auf dem schwedischen Arbeitsmarkt werden allenthalben gelobt. Wir in Deutschland hatten ebenfalls eine Periode der Reformfreude, deren Früchte wir auch in diesem Monat feiern konnten. Erstmals seit 16 Jahren gab es bei uns weniger als 3 Millionen Arbeitslose, aber es bleibt noch viel zu tun, gerade auch angesichts der neuen Herausforderung der Märkte. Deshalb wirbt die Initiative Neue Soziale Marktwirtschaft mit ihrer aktuellen Kampagne Einstieg in die Arbeit für Reformen, die mehr Beschäftigung und damit auch dauerhaft mehr Wohlstand in Deutschland schaffen. Erst im Juni begingen wir das 60-jährige Jubiläum der Wirtschafts- und Währungsreform in Deutschland, bei der Ludwig Erhard den Grundstein für die soziale Marktwirtschaft legte. Gerade in der heutigen Zeit der großen weltwirtschaftlichen Veränderungen und dem weit verbreiteten Gefühl der Unsicherheit ist es in Deutschland erforderlich, die Grundwerte der sozialen Marktwirtschaft neu zu beleben. Und das Anliegen der Initiative Neue Soziale Marktwirtschaft ist es, die soziale Marktwirtschaft im Sinne Ludwig Erhards neu zu beleben. Nicht im Sinne der Vergangenheitsorientierung, sondern im Hinblick auf die neuen und künftigen Herausforderungen. Die aktuelle Regierung Schwedens hat sich zum Ziel gesetzt, dem schwedischen Modell zu neuer Kraft zu verhelfen. Wir sind daher besonders gespannt auf die Erfahrungen, die Sie uns heute, Herr Minister, präsentieren werden. Meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, the Swedish experience, promoting growth and employment, lautet der Titel der heutigen Lektüre. Welche Maßnahmen haben also zu dem Erfolg der schwedischen Wirtschaft in den letzten Jahren geführt und welche Schritte stehen noch bevor? Was kann und was sollte Deutschland aus den schwedischen Erfahrungen lernen? Angesichts der eingangs erwähnten Krise der Finanzmärkte wird jedoch auch interessant sein, mehr über die Swedish Experience im Umgang mit der Bankenkrise Anfang der 90er Jahre zu erfahren. Schließlich fragen sich alle politischen Akteure zu Recht, wie sie am besten mit der aktuellen Lage umgehen sollten und wie der Weg in die Zukunft aussehen soll, in den es zunächst gilt, wieder Vertrauen zu schaffen. Aber all diese Fragen werden Sie, sehr verehrter Herr Minister, uns sicherlich aufschlussreiche und erhellende Anmerkungen darlegen. Wir freuen uns auf einen anregenden Vortrag und eine spannende Diskussion im Anschluss. Diese Diskussion wird von Herrn Gersemann moderiert werden, den ich an dieser Stelle ebenfalls sehr herzlich willkommen heißen möchte. But now, Mr. Minister, I'm very much looking forward to hearing you. And we are all very much interested to listen to you and to learn from the experience in Sweden. Minister, Mr. Minister, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Professor Tittmeier, ladies and gentlemen, this is obviously a time of trouble in the world economy. I think we all thought that when we had established price stability and fiscal stability, we would have created a much more strong foundation for our different European economies. But what we're realizing now is that we also have to rebuild the foundations for financial stability. I think the key issue for Sweden, for Europe, for the world is to restore confidence. This has not been a crisis of solvency or liquidity purely. It has been, at the center, a crisis of confidence. We have today in Sweden presented our stability plan this morning, and I'm sorry that we have to delay this presentation due to this, but it was of utmost importance for us to have a clear foundation for stability. What we have done is to, along lines of the other European countries, guarantee the bank lending up to 1,500 Swedish kronor that would obviously be paid for by the banks in terms of fees. We have also created an institution to inject capital, basically preferred shares, into troubled banks. We are now assessing the situation in the Swedish banks, and our conclusion is that the situation is stable, but we need to build the foundation and the structures for financial stability. And we've also created a structure for restructuring, an institution to restructure troubled banks. This is what we have done due to the experience we had in the previous Swedish crisis on the banking sector. I think we should be quite careful. These troubles are not over. In Sweden, we've done our part. The European Eurogroup has been very successful in its handling of the situation. I think we all should thank Mr. Trichet, we had on a picture here a few minutes ago, for the excellent work from the European Central Bank. But I think we should be aware that this crisis has taken new turns many times and has gone on longer than we all expected. So I think we should be very, very careful for the coming days and weeks and have a high alertness and readiness to act if we would see further problems. To some extent, the lecture I will give today could be called the Swedish model and the social market economy, because the basic theme that I will present is that we need to reinvent the social model of Europe. We need to increase the dynamism, we need to strengthen the growth forces, but at the same time we have to work to restore and strengthen social cohesion. Equality and efficiency can be promoted at the same time. And I do think that this is one of the essential messages that Ludwig Erhard was arguing for when he coined the phrase the social market economy, an economy based on dynamism but also on good work ethics, which was characterized by the high degree of social cohesion. I do think that we all could see a need for reform. We, a few years back, coined the Lisbon strategy in Europe to become the most dynamic and most growth-oriented economy of the world. We can clearly say that the gap between the US and Europe actually has widened since we started out with the Lisbon strategy. The growth has been 0.8% lower on average, productivity has been 0.7% lower on average, and we've seen on average an unemployment in Europe of 15%, while it has been 5% in the US. And obviously this is not only a matter of the challenge from the United States, but it is also a matter of globalization. We are now facing competition from the Asian economies and from the former Eastern and Central European countries. So the whole of Europe has to reinvent its social model to be better in place to handle a global competition. For Sweden, for Germany, for France, for Italy, this is obviously also a question about how to deal with an aging population. We are in a situation where over the coming decades there will be fewer people in the work active ages and more people that has to be supported. And that can only be solved by more people working in the labour market, but also the people that are working today working longer hours. Because we can't solve that problem with productivity increases. It has to be solved by increased labour supply. So we have to tackle the challenge for Europe in terms of the Lisbon agenda, but also in the terms of our own problems in terms of an ageing population. And that, I think, is the outset. I will first argue that the Swedish model, the Nordic model, have some important lessons to be used as an illustration of a social market economy. The model has been successful, but also widely misunderstood. It has been a very efficient mix of flexible labour market, high degree of labour force participation, with a strong emphasis on education quality, but also on redistribution based on provision of high quality welfare services rather than very, very extended and generous benefit systems. I will also argue that there are some problems in the Scandinavian or Nordic model that has to be dealt with. I will present the outline of our reform strategy, and I will make some more amateurish reflections on what this could mean for the German and the European economy in general. When we talk about the Scandinavian countries and Sweden, most people perceive this as being quite successful social model in terms of poverty reduction. We have probably the lowest income differences among the European countries. We have a high degree of social cohesion. Sweden is perceived, together with the other Nordic countries, as a well-organized society with a high degree of gender equality and a very open and tolerant society. It is important to see the historic past of this. Between 1870 and 1970, Sweden had the highest growth levels among all the industrial countries, almost 3% on average per year for 100 years. The reason for this was very much economic textbook in terms of the new growth literature. There was a high degree of internal competition. The guilds were abandoned. We had a general freedom to pursue any trade from the mid-19th century. Property rights were established and well respected. An efficient rule of law system in combination with land reforms that made people able to accumulate wealth to invest in other industries. We also early on had a high degree of economic freedom for women, which was important both in terms of equality but also in terms of productivity and human capital growth. It's interesting to note that the high degree of income equality in Sweden predates the welfare state. During the period of between 1870 and 1970, the degree of income distribution were becoming more equal. There were many reasons for it. A lot of these reforms that take away and breaks down social barriers also promotes equality. There was also historical reasons that was reinforced by the land reforms. Education was widely spread from early on in the Swedish society. And these reforms that I mentioned were quite important. But it is important to note that most of these achievements are predating the welfare state. And the early Swedish welfare state has also some very peculiar and special features. One was very high investments in education. This means that income differences are diminished on the basis of compression of productivity. With a high degree of education for the lowest educated, the need for income dispersion is less. And also we have had very strong but also very responsible trade unions. The membership of the union has been very broad and very to most trades. And this means that the unions also has to take responsibility for the whole of the society. And most of the welfare distribution has been built on the idea that we are going to distribute welfare services rather than to use transfer payments. I think this is a model that is less distortionary to the labour market and to the economy in general than a model based on benefit systems and high taxes. The work first principle was very strong in the Swedish welfare model. Most social systems had eligibility criteria based on work. The access to welfare were based on the fact that you were well established on the labour market. Most of the measures were in terms of active measures, search requirements to make people active on the labour markets, and also the benefit levels for a long time were quite modest. I think one of the reasons why the Swedish model was so successful was the very, very importance that was attached to work and work ethics, because social justice and work cannot be separated. The fact that people are on the labour market, that they are active, that they gain skill, that they are a part of the productivity gains, and the fact that they have the social security that is built on the fact that you have work comrades and that you're a part of achieving something in the workplace. So I think work ethics, the work first principle, and the model where work is a key to the social system is one of the reasons Sweden has functioned so well. We saw problems coming in the late 70s and early 80s due to the fact that the taxes increased and the benefit system increased. But at the same time, there were important countering reforms in the early 70s. In 1972, we abandoned the idea of family taxation. So at the same time, as the general tax level of the Swedish economy increased almost 10% over a five-year period, the marginal tax rate and the threshold tax rate for females were dramatically reduced. We also introduced high-quality childcare services to a wide range of families. 73, there was less than one-fifth of the families receiving childcare. In 1985, it was 50%, and today it is basically universal. And the fact that we abandoned family taxation and also introduced general childcare was very important, because the implicit tax level and also the implicit threshold for females to going into the labour market was actually, during a period of tax raises, dramatically reduced. This means that the labour participation among females from 1970 to 1980 increased from 60 to 80% of the population. It's also important to realise that the problems of the Swedish economy grew during the 70s and the 80s. Taxes were increased, the benefit systems in early retirement, sickness, unemployment increased. The whole idea of work ethics, work first, was undermined by high taxes and generous benefit system. The second problem, which was almost as important, was that we experienced a period of macroeconomic instability. Budget deficits, high inflation, and a series of devaluation where we tried to have a very active stabilization policy and to hinder the economic cycle to have its path. In this kind of environment, with high taxes, high benefits, increasing macroeconomic instability, we also saw a society shifting from saving and investments towards consumption and less degree of capital accumulation. Budget deficits were combined with large current account deficits, and the general investment level went down. We also saw a eurosclerosis tendencies, where the degree of competition in different markets was decreased. Obviously, the global shift towards a more entrepreneurial economy that happened during the 70s and 80s did not function so well, did not match so well a more eurosclerosic Swedish society. So the growth story: between 1870 to 1970, Sweden went from being one of the poorest countries to being one of the richest countries. Here it is. In 1970, we were number four in terms of GDP per capita in the world. To 1990, we had come down to the seventh place. In 1997, when the crisis were at its peak, Sweden had gone down to the 18th place among the OECD countries, 1/8. And today we are back at number 10. This reduction of economic standard was combined with an increase of social exclusion. If we go back to the early 70s, 10% of the workforce were in sickness benefits, early retirement, unemployment benefits, or active labour market measures. At its peak, it was a little bit less than one-fourth of the active population that was out of the labour market. For every crisis, unemployment went up. And then people entered early retirement, and we established ourselves on another higher level of social exclusion. With every crisis, the number of unemployment measures in terms of activity guarantees and so forth were increased. And over the whole of this period, the sickness benefits and early retirement increased. And this is in a country where we are living longer, experience a healthier life, doing more exercise, and probably having the most well-organized workplaces in the world. So obviously this was something that did not go very well in Sweden. The combination of the macroeconomic instability and the lacking growth figures started a reform process in the 90s. I would underline that the starting point was the fiscal restructuring. We had budget deficit of some 13% of GDP in the early 90s. And there was a tough period of fiscal restructuring that was also underpinned by important institutional reform. We today have a budget process that is much, much better than it was in the late 80s, early 90s. Then Sweden, Greece and Italy had the worst budget process. Today, Sweden, together with a few other countries, has among the most conservative budget process in Europe. But let me also underline that this is not only institution, it's also the political memory. When I have negotiations with my party leaders, at the end of the day, late at the night, when everybody has to make their sacrifices, it is the memory of the crisis that is leading and guiding us towards a conservative and stringent fiscal policy. Another very important component of the restructuring of the Swedish, reinvention of the Swedish model, was obviously the re-establishment of price stability. The fact that we have a central bank directed towards a long-term goal, a target-oriented policy, medium-term stability orientation, I think was of utmost importance. The idea that the central bank is independent and has the ability to uphold price stability, I think is a key feature for any well-functioning economy. Obviously, there's also been other reforms in terms of increased competition. We have deregulated telecommunication, transportation, electricity. And we've also done very important infrastructure and research investments. So if we look back in the early 90s, Sweden had three problems: lacking productivity growth, macroeconomic instability, and a high degree of social exclusion. The reforms that we did in the 90s solved the two of these problems, the productivity gains and the macroeconomic instability. But as late as 2005, we were not able to deal with the problem of social exclusion. And this is the reason why we set out on another wave of reforms. When we look ahead of these years, we know that from 1980 to 2010, on average, the demographic factors have contributed almost a percentage point in growth in Sweden. Between 2010 and 2050, the contribution will be zero. All growth on average will be built on productivity gains. And this is the change of demographics that we have to face up to. And it's actually the case that in the late 1998 to 2002, the situation actually deteriorated, because the sickness benefits increased quite dramatically from 3 to 6% over that period. And it was also the case that when we came out of the 9/11 crisis, we did not have any job growth in Sweden. We had a period where we had jobless growth for at least a 4 or 5 year period. And it was also clear that social exclusion is not evenly distributed in the society. It is mainly young people that delay their entry into the labor market. It is old people leaving the labor market earlier, especially people that has been working in low-paid jobs with less skills. We also have a problem of social integration of immigrants. And there's obviously also in the Swedish society been tremendous increases of gender equality, but the progress after 1990 has been very, very limited. So social exclusion has to be dealt with if we're going to deal with the demographic situation. But it has also to be dealt with if we have to come back with some more vigorous growth in terms of job creation. And it's also probably the most important social problem of the Swedish economy. Let me underline that our reform strategy is not built on the idea that we need a pure Anglo-Saxon market economy, that we need to abandon the social market economy, or that we have to abandon the Swedish model. We are starting out by building on what we see as strong points. Obviously, one is strong public finances. One of the things that I become increasingly convinced about is the need to run budget surpluses. The fact that you have these reoccurring crises, which we had in Mexico 95, in the Asian countries 97, Russia 98, and then we had the IT crash in 2001. And now again, only a few years later, we have another period of financial turmoil. I do believe that the only thing we can build to secure our society against these financial turmoils is to be an economy that is built on very solid foundations. And therefore, strong public finances is an important starting point for any kind of reform process. There cannot be arguments that you need reform and therefore you can be less stringent or less conservative in your public finances. Budget surpluses is the best foundation for any reform policy. The second starting point is that we want to built on the existing Swedish labour market model. We have a stable system for wage settings. We are among the countries in Europe with the lowest degrees of strikes and labour market conflicts. So we need to respect that there are social partners in the labour market and there is a need to find a balance between the two partners. It's also the fact that we have to build on a welfare state which is very much investing in education. Education, knowledge, human capital is the key starting point if we want to build a society with social cohesion, because it will be how well we educate the lowest educated in the society that is defining for how much wage dispersion that is needed. And we also think that the idea that we should provide welfare for all, childcare, healthcare, elderly care without regardless of income, is an efficient way of redistributing social welfare. It's much more efficient to provide social welfare services than it is to redistribute by transfer payments or tax increases, because both taxes and benefits are very problematic in terms of labour force participation. What we have done is to go along three basic reform lines. The first one is to make work pay. The second is to make it simpler and easier to hire people. And the third one is to increase the dynamism of the Swedish society by making it more attractive and more easy to become an entrepreneur. If we look at the make work pay strategy, I think it's important to realize that what we are dealing with is social exclusion. We want to get people out of the social welfare systems and back on the labor market. And then we know that labour supply is the crucial issue. We have to make it more rewarding, the stronger economic incentives to participate on the labour market. And therefore it is the threshold effect, how much money you make when you enter the labour market, rather than the marginal effect that is the key issue. We have to lower taxes for those groups that are outside of the labour market, and we have to make it worthwhile to go into the labour market, even if you're only working half time. Partly, I think this is due to sociological reasons. People that has a weak attachment to the labour market often also work in hierarchical organisations. They are working in jobs that are characterised as heavy, and their earning prospects are not that bright. It's also a matter that you often have situations where the families have a weak attachment to the labour market. Single mothers, single parents is a key group. And I also think it's important to realize that in most cases, it is the combination of different social systems that is most important. The fact that unemployment benefits, sickness benefits, social welfare benefits, housing benefits are interdependent and interlinked. So that for people with weak attachment for the labor market, the degree of income security from the combined social systems are often very high. We, for example, in Sweden have the situation where single parents might have a threshold effect of over 100%, that they will actually lose money when they enter the labour market. And that is a kind of poverty traps, a kind of welfare benefits traps that cannot be accepted. Because we have the situation that large groups then can migrate out from the labour market into the social benefit systems. So what was the policy response that we've tried? Well, first we've introduced an earned income tax cut. We've reduced the taxes on earned income, not on benefits, not on pensions, and not on other income, but on work income, earned income, with 2% of GDP. This means that if you're working half-time, your average tax has come down from 30% to 10% in a period of 5 years. So it's quite a dramatic shift in the size of the tax wedge to enter the labour market. We've also done quite a lot of reforms of unemployment benefits. We've kept a system where the unemployment benefits are rather generous for the first 3 months, but then the benefit levels are gradually reduced, and after 300 days you will also have to enter into a system of job and development guarantee, where the search intensity measures are more intense and where we are actually also reducing the leisure time for those that are unemployed. We've also changed the eligibility criteria for the unemployment benefits and also the financing of the system. So if a part of the labour market are driving up wages, and also affecting unemployment. That will also have an impact on the cost for their unemployment insurance. There's also been a huge shift in sickness insurance. We have strengthened our decision systems. We have introduced a national rather than a regional system, and there are professional decision-making rather than political decision-making. And we've also broadened the ways back from these benefit systems to work. And let me mention that we now have come down to the same levels of sickness benefits that we had in the 1960s. I received the current data just a few days ago, and we are still having a decrease of almost 20% compared to last year. Over 2 years, 180,000 people have left the benefit system. We have come down almost 4% of the population compared to the graph you see. For 2010, we are expecting to be back at 15% of the workforce on different benefit systems. An important part of the reforms has been different measures to make it more easy and less costly to hire. Our starting point is that we want to keep the basic features of the Swedish labour market. And some of them are problematic in terms of employment. We do have quite conservative employment protective legislation. We do have collective agreements that are establishing a quite high starting wage in the economy. So what we've done is try to compensate for that. We have reduced social fees from 33% to 10% or to 15% for people below 25 years of age. We have also completely abandoned social fees for people that has been out of the labour market on sickness benefits, early retirement or unemployment for more than a year. And they will be out. There will be no social fee payments for the same period as they have been out of the labour market. We have also introduced deductions to improve the household sector. The service sector in Sweden has been heavily hit by the high taxes and the regulation on that sector. So therefore, a special deduction for household services has been perceived as being efficient. And we've also changed the Labour Market Board, our authority for organising active measures. We have shifted towards much more of subsidies to working kind and to get people back into the labour market rather than participating in different educational schemes. In terms of entrepreneurship, and this is obviously very important if we want to be a dynamic economy, there has been good general conditions for corporations in Sweden, a well-educated population, a low degree of bureaucracy, high degree of competition on many of the product markets. But in terms of entrepreneurship, we have been lacking behind and lacking the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that is needed to be a real dynamic economy. So therefore, a key feature of our reform has to be to improve the situation for ownership. We have reduced we have abandoned the wealth tax. We have taken away the heritage taxes. And we've also reduced the property taxes so that the ownership becomes more of a central role of the economy. And I do think that when we look to the current economic crisis in the world, ownership, private property is a part of the solution. Big institution without active owners, big institution without direct personal responsibility, I do think is part of the problem. We do need strong entrepreneurs and strong ownership to be able to control the kind of forces that we have in the world economy. We have also reduced this year corporate taxation and social fees to be able to counter the downturn in the world economy. What are the effects of these reforms? Obviously, after 2 years, it's almost impossible to evaluate the effects. And I will also be very, very cautious and humble in that respect, because we will have to see what will pan out over the next maybe 4 or 5 years before we can draw any clear conclusions. But let me just mention that if the social exclusion increased from 10% to over 20% in 2005, we are already back at 16% this year. And we are expecting to come down to 15% at the end of 2010. Regular employment has on a long-term sustainable level, we foresee an increase of 2 to 3%. And the current assessment is that the reduction of equilibrium unemployment rate, the unemployment that is compatible and sustainable in terms of price stability, has been reduced from around 6% to 4 or 5%. So there's been a substantial reduction also in equilibrium unemployment rate. What are the general conclusions for Europe and Germany in particular from this? Well, I do think that one important conclusion is that in most European countries, social exclusion is a big problem. But it's also important to realize that social exclusion is different from the different countries. When we look to the southern Mediterranean economies, it's almost always the case that it's the older people that are leaving the labor market. While it's in Sweden or Holland or Denmark has been early retirement and sickness benefits that has been the major contributor. If we look to Germany, there are some specific features that I would like to point out. One is that long-term unemployment has been very, very problematic. It is clear that youth unemployment in Germany is less of a problem than it is in for example, Sweden. The German youth unemployment is much, much lower. But the long-term unemployment has been more sustained and higher. And it has not either, as I see it, been decreasing fast over the last few years. But it's also clear that in terms of old age and survivor benefits, there is a lot of people leaving the labor market earlier in Germany than it is in Sweden. We have been able to increase our average pension age with almost 1 year over the last 4 years. And also the employment rate among females are substantially lower. If you look at the differences here, you can see that when you look at the aggregated macro level, it seems to be quite acceptable. But when we then realize that 22% of the females in the German economy work less than 20 hours, and that almost 50% work part-time, it is clear that this is also a part of the social exclusion problem. So what can then be done? Well, I think that we should here be very, very cautious by drawing policy conclusions. All social systems has to be evaluated very, very carefully before you give policy advice. And I'm not an expert on the German economy, so I will see this as a few personal reflections rather than really strong policy advice. I do think that there is a need to increase female labor supply. In the latest Going for Growth from the OECD, they made a policy simulation where Europe could close the gap in terms of hours worked if we reduce the tax levels on females to the same level as in the US. It's a dramatic increase of female labor supply that could be possible in Europe in general, in Germany in particular. The idea of abolishing the joint taxation, I think, would be an excellent idea, at least an idea that we should consider seriously. And also improving the provision of high-quality, low-cost childcare, because female labor force participation is a key challenge. When it comes to older workers, in Sweden we've done a pension reform that makes the implicit tax level, the combination of tax and pension benefits that you earn when you work extra, is very, very low. And there is also a need for further reform here. But let me note that what we've done is to double the earned income tax cuts for people above 65 years. And that costs almost nothing. If anybody works above 65 from the year end this year, the tax level will only be 10% up until the threshold for state income tax. And this means that a lot of people will earn more money by staying on to the labor market. And we have also abolished social fees for 65 years and above. And given that this is a non-existing tax base, it almost costs nothing to the public finances, because we are cutting taxes on a non-existing tax base, to be quite precise. So the costs for us has been equal to less than a tenth of a percentage point of GDP. So you could do quite dramatic tax cuts for people of a little bit higher age to increase increase labor participation. In terms of long-term unemployment, I do think that different activity guarantees is what we really need to improve the search behavior, the search support, but also the control mechanism. The decrease of leisure time, I think, is a key issue when it comes to long-term unemployment. So what are the general conclusions? I do think we need a broad reform approach for Europe. It cannot be a discussion of only supply-side reforms. Yes, supply-side reform is a key issue. We have to increase labour supply. We have to make the labour market function better. We have to increase the search behaviours from those that are outside of the labour market. But we also need demand-side reforms, reducing social fees, reducing hiring costs to make people, to reduce the threshold to come back into the labour market. So a broad reform strategy, I think, is much more likely to be successful than just implementing a few reforms. It's also very important to note that most of the social systems are interlinked. If you do reforms on the unemployment benefits without doing reforms on early retirement, there is a big risk that the exclusion is moving from one social system to another. So we need a systematic approach to the whole of the welfare benefit systems. And I also do think that we have to address the issue of social cohesion directly. The most important counter-argument to reforms and to strengthen dynamism is the social side effects for people that are less well off, that have a weaker position on the labour market. This is also, I think, one of the reasons why tax cuts had to be directed to people with a weaker attachment to the labour market and why it is so important to reduce the thresholds effect. Because if we want to build a society of social cohesion in the longer term perspective, I do think that work participation is of the essence, both in terms of the wage prospect, because people on the labour market participate in productivity growth, but also in the essence of being a social market economy, that people are social animals that need to cooperate and need the security from the cooperation and the support from others. I also think that if we want to build a society based on social cohesion, early investments in education, from early on in the childhood, but also in the general schooling system, is of the utmost importance. The fact that Sweden, Germany, Austria, the Netherlands are experienced that large parts of the population are leaving the schools without sufficient knowledge to have a secure place in the labour force, on the labour market, is obviously not acceptable. We have to strengthen the education system for the whole of society, but also for the social cohesion. I do think that historically there's been an argument that we have a trade-off between equality and efficiency. I think in Europe we are so far from that trade-off that we can make improvement both in terms of social cohesion and an economic efficiency. Every person that is coming back to the labour market, that leaves the social exclusion, leaves the welfare benefit system, is of a great gain for the whole of society. So if we want to rise to the challenge of global competition, if we want to reduce taxes and keeping our public finances on a stringent and sustainable path, it is important that we reduce social exclusion. So I believe that the message of a social market economy from Ludwig Erhard is a message that is clear and strong today, and that there is a reform strategy for Europe where we could rebuild social cohesion and economic dynamism at the same time. And that, I think, was of the essence of the message from Ludwig Erhard and his idea of a social market economy. Thank you very much.
Susanne?
Ja.
Yes, do you want me to come in?
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Wir haben jetzt noch, ich bin Olaf Gersenmann von der Welt, Welt am Sonntag hier in Berlin. Wir haben jetzt noch Zeit für einige Fragen aus dem Publikum. Ich möchte mir allerdings erlauben, die erste Frage selber zu stellen. Herr Boy, Sie haben vor allem darüber geredet, wie man das Arbeitsangebot verbessern kann in Europa und haben am Anfang eine Statistik genannt, wonach das Wirtschaftswachstum in Amerika zwischen 1995 und 2006 0,8% höher war als in Europa und das Produktivitätswachstum 0,7% höher. Wenn ich mich nicht ganz vertue, folgt daraus, dass der große Unterschied zwischen Amerika und Europa in dieser Zeit nicht war, dass die Beschäftigung in Amerika nennenswerter gestiegen ist, sondern die Produktivität deutlich stärker gewachsen ist. Warum also dieser Fokus auf eine Erhöhung des Arbeitsangebots, also Labor Supply, wie Sie es nannten, und nicht so sehr auf Maßnahmen, die die Produktivität auch stärker steigern würden in Europa?
Well, obviously that is an important question, but if we, for example, look at the aging population, this is a general European problem. If we would increase productivity, the impact on long-term sustainability would be very limited, because we would obviously increase the tax revenues from due to higher wages, but also the costs of the provision of the welfare service in the public sector would go up, because we have a general tendency that the wage rates will increase about the same rates in the whole society. So when we do this long-term calculation, if you increase labor supply and increase productivity, the impact on public sustainability of public finances is much higher if we increase labor supply. The second reason is that if we need to reform Europe to lower taxes and reduce the burdens on the business sector, if we compare ourselves to the strong growth economies, it's not that we are investing more in education in Europe. It is not that we are investing more in infrastructure. The big difference on if we look at the tax levels in Europe and the more dynamic part of the world, one of the big differences is that we have to pay for the social exclusion. So anybody that is coming back out of a welfare benefit system and start contributing in terms of tax payments is a huge improvements in terms of ability to increase investments in education or being able to cut taxes. So I do think that hours worked, the number of people on the labor market and the number of hours that people are working when they are at their workplace is quite important. Also in terms of global competition, but also in terms of dealing with demographics.
Okay, vielen Dank. Ich glaube, eine Dame, rot. Können Sie sich kurz vorstellen?
Ja, guten Tag. Renate Hornung-Draus von den deutschen Arbeitgebern, BDA. Ich habe eine Frage an den Minister. Und zwar, Herr Borg, Sie erwähnten ja das sehr spezielle Arbeitsmarktsystem in Schweden mit starken Gewerkschaften, hohen Einstiegslöhnen, die durch Tarifverträge ausgehandelt sind. Meine Frage an Sie ist, wie wird Ihr System mit den Herausforderungen des erweiterten Binnenmarktes mit der Dienstleistungsfreiheit fertig? Wie passen Sie sich an? Sie haben sehr wenig vom Binnenmarkt gesprochen. Und ganz konkret möchte ich Sie fragen, wie wird Ihre Regierung die Situation, die Arbeitsmarktordnung in Schweden anpassen an die jüngsten Urteile des Europäischen Gerichtshofes, insbesondere das Urteil zum Fall Vaxholm-Laval, wo ja eine schwedische Gewerkschaft einen lettischen Dienstleistungserbringer in den Bankrott boykottiert hatte, was also von ausländischen Dienstleistungserbringern sehr stark als Protektionismus angesehen wurde. Wie werden Sie darauf reagieren?
Well, obviously this is a very important point to make. My point is that the Swedish-Scandinavian model, when it worked well, combined strong unions and very strong economics incentives for labour market flexibility. So when we reduced the strong economics driving forces for economic flexibility and kept the very strong unions, then we had the prerequisite of a sclerotic labor market. So what we're trying to do is to reinvent the old model by reintroducing much stronger economic flexibility incentives in terms of labor market, in terms of earned income tax credits. So any reform strategy has to make trade-offs. We could argue that we need to deregulate our employment protection legislation in Sweden or reducing the strength of the unions. But according to my reading of the research, employment protection legislation have very limited impact on the average unemployment. It has an impact on youth unemployment, immigrant unemployment, and the unemployment for older people. So therefore, we have centered our reform strategy on unemployment benefits, sickness benefits, and also earned income tax credits, because we wanted to restore the economic driving forces for a more dynamic and flexible labor market. And I think we also should respect that there is always a need for people to have security in the labor market. So if you introduce stronger economic driving forces, it would also be very difficult to start to reform employment protection laws, because you would then increase the uncertainty for wage earners on so many angles that the situation will be much less secure. Well, I think the Swedish economy is starting to adapt to the internal market competition. There is changes, I know, among the unions and employers discussed about the Laval case. I do think that the idea of collective bargaining is quite efficient. I don't want to have state minimum wages, and I don't want to have state laws forcing any collective agreements to become implemented of the whole of the labour market. Because then we are actually saying to the unions, you don't have to take responsibility. And I do think the fact that we have introduced experience rating in the financing, 1/3 of the unemployment benefits are depending on the fees for unemployment benefits, are depending on unemployment in the different sectors. So when the construction workers are driving wages up and unemployment up, the fees goes up and the membership of the construction workers is going down. So I think with better economic incentives and stronger economic driving forces, we could reinvent a more flexible and more dynamic labour market model, while at the same time keeping what we see as important features to also uphold a social stability on the labour market.
Okay, der Herr hier in der dritten Reihe, danach der Herr davor in der zweiten.
Yeah. I'm Ambassador of Liechtenstein, and I first wanted to congratulate for your tax reductions. The tax rates you mentioned actually are lower than in Liechtenstein today. My question is concerning the abolishment of the inheritance taxation. How was the contribution to the state budget before you abolished inheritance tax? Did you have to compensate for this income for the state? And was it possible to analyze the effect on the economy?
Yes. Well, I do think probably the Swedish tax rates are too high compared to Liechtenstein. So we have some way to come before we are competitive in that respect. But we are no longer the highest tax country in the world. The Danes have now taken that position. And I have the hope that we've made a joke that our prime minister is becoming 45 in 1 or 2 years, and we will probably be below 45% in tax rate before he is 45 years old. So there is improvements here. Well, it was actually the Social Democratic government that abolished the inheritance tax. We have taken away the wealth tax, and we've also reduced the property tax. I think the combination of inheritance tax, wealth tax and property tax is taxation on private ownership. And I do think that in the longer term perspective, reinventing dynamism and entrepreneurship is very much about reinventing an ownership economy. And I do think that this will have a great impact if we look 5 or 10 years ahead. But it's very, very difficult to assess whether it has any impact this year or next year. We perceive that this is an important contribution for the growth strategy, but I do think that it's actually in the much more longer-term perspective that this would be an important contribution to an entrepreneurial society.
Der Herr in der zweiten Reihe, danach Herr Gerster.
Ja, Dieter Kühn, IG Metall. Ich habe folgende Frage. Wenn ich richtig informiert bin, sind Ihre Banken ja verstaatlicht. Deswegen sind Sie wahrscheinlich von diesen Schrottimmobilienkäufen ja nicht betroffen, denn Sie konnten das ja kontrollieren. Aber ist das so? Und sind Ihre Manager nach oben im Gehalt begrenzt worden durch die Verstaatlichung? Dankeschön.
Well, to be quite honest, we had one big state bank. That was actually the main cause of the banking crisis back in 92. About 2% of GDP of the losses were from the Nordbanken, who was a state-owned bank at that time. So I don't think that state-owned bank is a solution to economic irresponsibility. But what I do think is that the private owners of the banks will have to pay due consequences for irresponsible behavior. One of the features of the solvation of the Swedish banking crisis was that we actually took over the ownership of the banks. We had for Sparbanken, for example, a preferred share with a factor of 10 times the voting power, which means that we own the bank with 5% of the capital. That was very important to force the other banks to realize that they should not be running for state aid. Because state aids, I think, should be the ultimate solution. We can't find any other solution to these kind of problems. And you also need to inject capital, because given the capital requirements, the leverage of introducing own capital is 33 times the money. So if you want to solve this problem like they have in the US by starting to buy toxic assets, you can buy how much you ever could find, because these markets are like the ocean. You can't solve it by buying up toxic asset. You have to inject ownership capital into the banks. And what we have done today is to establish guarantees for bank lending, but we've also set up an organization to be able to inject capital. We don't have troubled banks today, but if they come to us, there will be a question of ownership. Because we also think that the taxpayer should not only take responsibility for the downside. If we would guarantee their financing or loan them money, the taxpayers would only take responsibility for the downside. But when we inject ownership capital, preferred shares, the taxpayers will also gain on the upside. So we used almost 2.5% of GDP back in 92 to solve the banking crisis. And all of that has been restored. And we are still owning Nordbanken. So we can eventually, I think we could be able to sell that and use this money for infrastructure or productive investments. So I do think that we need to have social control over the banks. I think the central banks have the utmost important job here to do, to control the private banks and to control that they are not being irresponsible. Our FSA, the different financial control institution of our countries, have to cooperate and see that that these international banks are under close supervision. And I also think that we need to build institutions to be able to deal and restructure bad banks when they actually fail. Because we can't say that we are going to solve these problems. I think we will see a reoccurring financial crisis in the future. What we can do is to establish price stability. We can establish fiscal stability, and we can establish institutions to deal with financial stability. But I do think that the part of the globalized economy is that every 4 to 5 years we will have this kind of problems. And I mean, when we're talking about Ludwig Erhard, we can remember his close associate Friedrich von Hayek, where he was arguing for these over credit expansion cycles that they saw in the 30s and the 40s. And to that respect, I think we are seeing to some extent the same kind of crisis today. Over expansions of credit, irresponsible lending, and the lack of private capital in ownership in the banks.
Herr Gerster, Sie verzeihen, wenn ich mich kurz vordränge. Auf einen Aspekt der Frage sind Sie nicht eingegangen, und zwar die Sache der Entlohnung von Bankern. Wir haben jetzt in Deutschland hier in den letzten Tagen eine Diskussion gehabt, und zwar wird wohl die Bundesregierung eine Bedingung stellen an Banken, die Kapital aufnehmen vom Staat, der zufolge halt Vorstandsmitglieder nicht mehr verdienen dürfen als 500.000 Euro. Wenn ich die Nachrichtenagenturen richtig verstehe, werden auch Sie in Zukunft die Gehälter regulieren von Banken, bei denen Sie einsteigen. Aber offenbar ist das beschränkt auf Gehaltssteigerungen. Können Sie uns genau sagen, was Sie da machen und warum Sie offenbar einen sanfteren Ansatz wählen als die Bundesregierung?
Well, what we have been saying is that if a bank to some extent is has its capitals, its capital guaranteed by the state, it is not an achievement to be able to make profit on the basis of a state guarantee. That's not a productive work. It's just the fact that you're making money out of a state guarantee. So what we've said is that there will be a wage freeze, there will be no bonuses, and the parachutes will be based on the same kind of system that we have for the state sector during the period when we have this kind of state guarantees. And I also think that this is actually, from moral perspective, quite reasonable. When you take up public service, when you do public service in a public organization or as a politician, you don't expect to have the same kind of wages as they have in the private sector. So when a bank becomes dependent on state aid or state guarantees, it's also very reasonable that they reduce their wages and that they take responsibility for reducing bonuses. In the longer term perspective, I do think that this is a matter of financial stability. We have to set rules for wages and bonuses for the banking sector. Because if we taxed earned income less to make people work, if we reduce unemployment benefits to make people search more, it's also quite clear if we give people bonuses to take extreme risks, they will take extreme risks. Economics incentive works also on bankers. So if we give them bonuses to make economic risk-taking the key of their profession, there will be excessive economic risk. So I do think that it should be a part maybe of the Financial Stability Forum or IMF discussions or discussions among the ECOFIN ministers to find rules. I don't mind if bankers are well paid, but the pay should give driving forces and incentives to behave in a way that is sustainable with long-term stability.
Ist das denn eine Sache, die tatsächlich regiert? Is this something governments should take care of, or could this be left over to the banks? I mean, because banks now have a massive incentive to actually rethink how they are paying their own managers.
Well, I actually think that it should be a part of a framework for how they conduct their businesses. When we discuss capital requirements, when we discuss supervision, when we discuss transparency and evaluation of these different products, financial instruments, we should also be discussing how they are paying their managers, because that's obviously something that is related to the stability of the system in a long-term perspective. I do believe in economics incentives. If we give people strong incentives to take extreme risks, they will.
I guess so.
Florian Gerste, früher Politiker, heute Unternehmensberater. Ich habe zwei Fragen. Herr Borg, die erste Frage. Sozialstaatsreformen gelingen den kleinen nördlichen europäischen Staaten deutlich besser als den großen kontinentaleuropäischen Staaten. Liegt das auch oder im Wesentlichen daran, dass die soziale Homogenität in ihren Ländern größer ist und dass man dort auch besser Verträge schließen kann, gesellschaftliche Verträge, wie zum Beispiel in Holland den Vertrag von Wassenaar in den 80er Jahren. Gelingt das besser und haben wir aus Ihrer Sicht größere Probleme, weil bei uns alles gegen Widerstände durchgesetzt werden muss? Zweite Frage, der schwedische Sozialstaat ist immer noch etwas aufwendiger als der deutsche. Er verlangt mehr Steuern im Wesentlichen und andere Formen der Finanzierung. Gibt es bei Ihnen Unmut in der Mittelschicht oder oberhalb der Mittelschicht über die Finanzierung dieses Aufwandes oder haben Sie den sozialen Frieden auch bei denen, die im Wesentlichen dafür zahlen, aber nicht so viel davon bekommen?
Well, to some extent, I think the Nordic countries have been forced to do more welfare reforms. We are very small economies. In every crisis that we've seen in the Asian or the Russian crisis, a small economy with a small stock market that is heavily dependent on foreign ownership will be hit by this global turmoil. So I think what we can do is to try to inject stability, price stability, fiscal stability, financial stability. That is the kind of framework that we can build to protect ourselves from this market turmoil. So in that respect, the smallness is a disadvantage that's become an advantage. We are less secure because we are a smaller country, but on the other hand, that also forces us to do more reform. So that might be a factor. I do believe then that for the whole of Europe, it's obviously much more important that the reform process that has started in Germany will continue. That we see that the reforms in unemployment benefits are not rolled back, and that the continuous work of the previous and this government to increase the strength of the economy is continued. That is, I think, very, very important. I think we can already see over the last few years that the restoration of German economic confidence has been important. The fact that Germany again can argue for fiscal stringence, that Germany can be a part of the Ecofin Council that are saying that we should uphold sustainable public finances and so forth is of utmost importance for the whole of Europe. So, yes, the bigger countries are the key to restore growth and stability for the whole of Europe. When it comes to reforming the welfare state, I mentioned Friedrich von Hayek, another well-known philosopher and thinker that was closely connected to Mr. Erhard was Karl Popper. And I think the idea, the concept he introduced of social piecemeal engineering is of importance. When we built up the welfare state, it took 30, 40 years, and there were many small steps going in, some in the right direction, some in the wrong direction. I think the reform process also must be piecemeal. We have to do changes to make it more worthwhile to work, introduce more flexibility to the labor market, stronger incentives for entrepreneurship. But every small step has to be in the right direction. So I don't think that you could argue for the kind of break of social system that we saw in the Central Eastern European system that was very popular in the debate maybe 10, 15 years ago. I think piecemeal social engineering is the way to adjust a society, because people are uncertain in times of change. And therefore, we have to deal with the question of social cohesion when we try to formulate reform plans. I think one of my European colleagues said that the problem is not that we don't know what has to be done. The problem is how to get elected to do it. And the second problem is how to get re-elected once you've done it. So I think the key question when we talk about reform is how to find social cohesion, social distributive issues as a part of the reform plan to make it more socially acceptable.
Der Herr, der dort steht.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. My name is Sergius Street. I'm from Sweden.
Können Sie einen Moment noch warten?
I'm sorry.
Herr Gess hat noch eine Nachfrage.
Yes, we are trying to do some changes. There has obviously been a political support among the middle class, and also, I would say, among quite a large degree of the labor unions members, because we've tried to be peaceful in our way of dealing with this. But I must admit that after we have started doing most of these reforms, there's also been a tremendous shift in the public opinion, because there will always be opposition against reforms, and obviously. Even so, not so much from the middle class, but more from the working class, so to speak.
Jetzt aber.
Okay. So my name is Sergius Street. I'm from Sweden. So I'd like to thank my finance minister for his lecture here. You mentioned this crisis of 1990-1991, and the bailout of the banks that time cost about 200,000 jobs in the industry out of a total of 1 million, which is quite a lot in a country of just 9 million inhabitants. This time, I think that 90s crisis was peanuts compared to now, because that time it was only a housing bubble, housing crisis mostly. This time it's, an enormous amount of financial, debt, toxic waste, quadrillions of financial derivatives, for example. that has to be reorganized, and you have to have some kind of bankruptcy reorganization where you separate that out of the tangible assets, right? So there have been a number of proposals for a new financial system, a new Bretton Woods agreement by your colleague in Italy, Giulio Tremonti, that has also been taken up by Nicolas Sarkozy, and here in Germany by Horst Köhler. There's also a different variant, which is actually the opposite Bretton Woods system, taken up by Gordon Brown. So my question is, I mean, Sweden, obviously as a small country, will not be able to be the author of such a new Bretton Woods conference. But what one can do as a small country is to be sort of a catalyzer, take this up and support what Tremonti and Sarkozy had been bringing up. So my question is, will you, Anders Borg, you know, have the guts to do that on an international level? For, you know, not only for the sake of protecting the Swedish, you know, citizens, but also for the whole world. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, let me start out with saying that I actually think that the Swedish crisis in 1990 to 92 was, for us, much worse than what is now going on. We had a house price fall of 30 to 50%. We have a real interest increase, I think it was of 5-6% in 2 or 3 months in 1991. We have the currency that was overvalued with some 15%. We had the budget deficit of some 13%. And at the same time, we had a period where almost all of our banks were close to or at the verge of bankruptcy. So for us, that was obviously a much more dramatic period than we are currently living through. And I think the reason for that was that we mismanaged our monetary and fiscal policy stability for at least 20 to 30 years before the problem started. So I do think that we, on an institutional basis, are better off today, not only in Sweden, but in general. We have independent central banks that are oriented towards price stability. We have much better quality of our public finances today than we had 10, 15 years ago. The idea of introducing market-oriented reforms are quite popular in most European countries. So I do think that we are now moving in the right direction. I do believe that we need to reinvent and revigor our Bretton Woods institutions. I do believe that, being more of a modest kind of conservative person, that we should work with the existing institutions. I think the International Monetary Fund is an important institution, and also the World Bank. And I think we should try to restore their activity and to restore their confidence. But let me also underline that this could not be an argument for not taking our own national responsibility. We are currently having 26 countries in Europe trying to deal with financial stability. I think we need a very, very, very high activity level in almost all capitals over the next 10 to 15 days to be able to put in place all the nice words and principles that we've put on a paper at the summit a week ago. Now we have to build institutions. Now we have to raise capital. Now we have to make the laws and take the decisions in Parliament. So I do think that the national responsibility is the starting point, because there will be no credible agreement if there are not credible institutions on the national level.
Okay, ich glaube, hier vorne war noch eine Frage, genau.
Herr Borg, mein Name ist Perger, ich bin Journalist. Ihr Diskurs über den Faktor Erziehung im Zusammenhang mit Social Cohesion hat mich sehr interessiert. Interessiert mich auch in dem Kontext, dass ich Sie frage, für uns war ja Schweden und das schwedische Modell auch im Bereich der Erziehung schon seit einiger Zeit interessant. Sie haben jetzt eher den Eindruck erweckt, als würde Ihre Regierung mit Erziehungsreform gerade erst beginnen. Mich interessiert aber jetzt, wie steht das im Zusammenhang mit Ihrem Verzicht auf Steuerleistungen? In Deutschland wird das sehr stark diskutiert, mit der Notwendigkeit, auch Mittel für Investitionen in die Erziehung zu beschaffen. Während Sie uns ja erzählt haben, auf welche Steuereinnahmen Sie jetzt schon verzichtet haben, Wie schaffen Sie das? Und wenn Sie gestatten, habe ich noch eine Frage. In der Krise verändert sich viel und das verändert sich auch jetzt viel Bewusstsein. Wirkt sich das denn in Schweden auch aus, in der Frage, ob Sie der gemeinsamen Währung in absehbarer Zeit beitreten würden?
Thank you very much. I think that's an excellent question. I think it's very important to realize that the impact of taxes on the economy or the impact of public expenditures are very much dependent on what kind of taxes we are talking about and what kind of public expenditures we are talking about. One of the reasons why Sweden and Scandinavia had such efficient economies was that up until the early 70s, we were basically investment in healthcare, childcare, education, elderly care. That was distributive policies based on the idea that everybody should have the access to high-quality welfare services regardless of income, which is very efficient in terms of distribution because it's a very important part of social security that people have access to those kind of services. And obviously some of the public expenditures, education, childcare, is also very important to increase labor supply. In other terms, if we have over-generously unemployment benefits, early retirements or sickness benefits, people will leave the labor market. So it's not a matter of public expenditure or private versus public responsibility. It's also a matter of what kind of public expenditures we are using. And I'm not saying that this government invented child care or education reforms. No, I mean, this has been a key for, I would say, the last 10 to 15 years to try to restore the quality of the education system. But we do have a long way to go in terms of restoring education quality. So I think I don't want to give the impression that we took over an economy that was in severe problems. I mean, the productivity and growth numbers were quite good, but we had this big problem of social exclusion. And when I'm talking about reducing taxes, it's partly on the basis of reducing social exclusion. Because if we want to come down substantially in tax level, you can't have 20% of the population being dependent on social welfare systems in the active ages. I'm not talking about making old people come back to the labor market. I'm talking about making people start to work when they are 21 or 22 years old, not 29 years, which we have currently the starting age today in Sweden. I'm talking about getting females back to the labor market on an equal basis with men. I'm talking about improved integration. And I'm talking about the fact that we don't need to see 55-year or 60-year-old people leaving the labor market. This is people with a dynamic force in energy that should be used and should be utilized for the good of society. I've made a joke that we should make the golf courses of Sweden deserted. And I do think that that's a good part of it, because when we look at people in their 50s, 60s or 70s today, this is people with a lot of energy and force that could be a very, very strong contribution for society. So I'm not talking about forcing people back to the labor market that actually have some kind of real health problem or so. It's better to have younger people come back. Integration to function better, more gender equality, and to get rid of the age discrimination that I think is a factor of the labor market today.
Wir müssen leider jetzt gleich zum Ende kommen. Eine Frage noch, Herr Engelen, als letzter.
Ja. The Euro question.
I'm sorry. I do think that it would be important for Sweden to become a member of the euro area. I think most of the problems that people foresaw with the euro has not established itself or materialized. ECB has, during the last crisis, shown that they are a very flexible, price stability-oriented central bank that has conducted their business in a commendable way. So I think that the euro has functioned very well for Europe, and it would be an advantage for Sweden to join. But as long as we uphold inflation targeting with low price stability, as long as we uphold strong public finances, as long as we build structures for financial stability, we can stay outside. So we can stay outside without causing economic problems for ourselves. But in terms of politics, I think it would be a clear advantage. Sweden should be a core part of Europe, participating in this cooperation. And obviously, when more and more countries join the euro, we will be more and more isolated in the ECOFIN Council if we are not participating. So I strongly believe that Sweden should join the euro area. But I must admit that I think we have some 60% of the population that believe that we should stay out. So it might take some time.
Okay. Letzte Frage, Herr Engelen. Aber hinten eine Frage? Okay, dann nicht. Okay, dann eine Alternative. Die Dame da hinten.
Hello, my name is Tesra Mensah. Now, it has been said by one of the former heads of the IMF that the meltdown of the markets is for the City of London and Wall Street what the fall of the wall was for capitalism. Now, as far as I know, no one here or really any of the well-known economists foresaw this meltdown coming. We had a lot of discussion about a credit crunch and a subprime mortgage crisis and so forth in the United States. And what's really happening now has come as a surprise to everyone, except American economist Lyndon LaRouche, who is the actual original author of the proposal for a new Bretton Woods system. So I wanted to ask Mr. Borg, what he thinks of the proposal to cancel all financial derivatives and to have a Roosevelt type of reorganization of the financial system. Since what is happening right now is the only person that foresaw this was Lyndon LaRouche.
Yeah, yes. Well, I do believe that we have to restore the structures of stability in the financial system. I do think that this is obviously a matter of capital requirements, of supervision, and so forth. So there is a lot of need to reforms to strengthen the fabrics of stability in the financial system. And I do think that is basically a national responsibility, even if international cooperation is of utmost importance. And when we talk about a new Bretton Woods, I think it's basically in terms of strengthening the existing IMF and World Bank functioning so that we could have... I wouldn't say that this is the end of deregulated financial markets, because I do think that we have had regulations in the financial markets, but we have to be much more cautious, much more conservative in the way we oversee and supervise these financial institutions so that their behavior is in the long term also in line with financial stability for the different countries.
Herr Minister, vielen Dank. Meine Damen und Herren, vielen Dank. Wir müssen jetzt leider die Veranstaltung beenden. Der Minister hat natürlich noch weitere Verpflichtungen, aber das letzte Wort hat natürlich Herr Tietmeier.
Vielen Dank. Ich wollte nur noch ein letztes Wort sagen. First of all, I would like to thank you very, very much for your lecture. And especially for the contributions to the discussion. You addressed a lot of very interesting points, and I'm tempted to discuss with you a lot of points, but you can be sure I will not do so. But thank you very much for delivering the lecture. I think it is very useful for us in Germany to learn from other countries, and I think we can learn from your country a lot of things, and this is very, very important. Herr Gersemann, ich möchte auch Ihnen sehr herzlich danken für die Moderation. Let me only conclude by saying, all this reminded me, the discussion today, reminded me of the three C's I brought into the qualifications criteria, the three C's I brought into the international discussion in the 70s already. That is, policymakers must be, and policy must be consistent in itself. That means it cannot be done without internal consistency. The second point is, it must be done on a continuous basis. To do policy only for some weeks without taking into account the longer term. That is never a convincing policy. And now I'm coming to my third C, that is the credibility. The credibility of the policymakers itself, not only of the policy, but also of the credit of the policymakers itself. And you have shown today that you are really fulfilling, in my view, the three C's, the so-called three qualification criteria for a good policy. Politics, and especially a member of the government. Thank you very much for coming to Berlin. Thank you very much for delivering your speech, your lecture, and especially for telling us what we can learn from Sweden.
Thank you very much.
Meine Damen und Herren, die Veranstaltung ist dann geschlossen. Thank you.